Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and later permanently archived at alexlinder.com. Today we're going to resume The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, Volume 3, The Leo Frank Case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man. We're going to do pages 49 through 84, the end of the Predator and Prey section. There are no numbered chapters in this book of roughly 500 pages, a few more for the index. But the text itself ends before there. Anyhow, as I say, the Predator and Prey section, picking up on page 49, we have a graphic of the layout of the National Pencil Company, and it's titled Mary Fagan Murder Scene. April 26th, 1913, shortly after noon, as she goes in to get her pay stub. So going into the building, you're in front, you're looking to your right. She goes in on the first floor. Then she hits the stairs about a quarter of the way through the first floor, goes up to the second floor, and see there's a door that can be locked midway on the stairs. And that's what the watchman, Conley, would be sitting there, able to lock or unlock it. Anyway, she goes up the stairs in the second floor and then back to the left, say, and into the outer office and then the inner office, passing by the elevator as she goes into Leo Frank's office, gets her pay, and then asks him if there's metal for her to come to work on Monday. He says, I don't know if the metal's arrived yet. Let's go check. So on the second floor, so from the left side, they go all the way down to the very opposite end of the building on that same second floor, and that's the metal room where Mary Fagan worked, and that's where he advances on her. She rejects him and he punches her. She falls back and hits her head, and then he cuts some cord and strangles her. And then he calls down to the night watchman on the first floor, or I'm sorry, not the night watchman, to the janitor on the first floor. He comes up and they dispose of the body by going down the elevator and then dragging the body back to the corner by the incinerator and leave it there. And this is a four-floor building. And the action took place on the first floor, the second floor, and the down in the basement. Turning on to page 50, the evidence. The state's case was built upon legitimate evidence, though there was one unusual feature that placed this prosecution in a class by itself. Key pieces of the state's theory relied on the testimonies of black witnesses to convince an all-white male jury that a prominent white male defendant, again, they're not calling him a Jew, they're calling him a white male, was a murderer deserving of death. So what's unusual in this case, which was the biggest up to that point in Georgia state history, most expensive, was they were going to have to rely on black testimony to get their theory across. The state solicitor, Hugh Dorsey, felt he could overcome that significant anomaly, and he assembled a case he would bring to a Georgia courtroom in August of 1913. And last time I read completely through all the footnotes. This time I'm going to read the ones that have quotes in them, and I'll leave the others aside because they're mainly newspaper citations. And if you check, you can find some of this stuff online. People have gone to the trouble of digging the papers up. There were three dailies that covered this and others that covered it as well, nationally and also magazines as well as newspapers. But three in Atlanta at least covered it. And then Tom Watson's two that weren't dailies, but the point is, most of these references are to stuff that was reported daily as we get into the trial. And you can find that some places online. Also, you can get the book if you truly want the all the references to the specific daily reports on the case. But I will read the ones that are worth reading just to make it flow a little better. So, she's murdered in April. And prosecutor Hugh Dorsey has his case ready to go by August of 1913. And then in dark print, allegation, Leo Frank murdered Mary Fagan in the metal room, which is located on the second floor down the hall from Frank's office, as described. Evidence, police found splattered blood spots in the form of a fan on the floor in the metal room. A police officer testified, "I should judge the area around these splotches was a foot and a half. It looked like a white substance had been swept over it." Factory manager N.V. Darley testified, "It looked like there had been an attempt to hide," unquote, "the blood spots. The white stuff practically hid the spots." The white substance, known as Haskalene, H-A-S-K, was sold and used as a lubricant for factory machinery. Only Frank appeared to have knowledge that it was actually made of, quote, "soap and oil," unquote, and thus he would have understood its value as a cleaning agent. Again, he's the one managing the factory, so he would know about all the ingredients used in the products, cleansers and lubricants, etc. So, footnote 96, Frank quoted in brief, 212.13, ONI, ATDSR, 10, Frank's father-in-law, Emil Selig, had a thriving family business. West Disinfecting, the, quote, "largest manufacturer of disinfectant in the world." Also, Atlanta Journal, August 15, 1913, number 4. Several witnesses said the blood spots were not there on the Friday before the murder. So, you know, when they all, Confederate Memorial Day on Saturday, so they're, when they left Friday, they cleaned it up, and there are no blood spots there. But they are there on Monday. 97, that was a footnote after that sentence. Brief 26 to 29, brief 10, Officer Starnes, quote, "I found a nail 50 feet this side of the metal room toward the elevator on the second floor that looked like it had blood on top of it. It was between the office and the double doors. I chipped two pieces off on the back door, which looked like they had bloody fingerprints." On April 26th, Frank spent nearly all of his time at the factory on the second floor. Evidence. Several strands of hair were found dangling from a lathe, hair strands that witnesses insisted were not there on Friday when the factory closed. The two wounds to Fagan's head, one on the face, the other on the back of the head, caused hemorrhaging beneath her skull and produced unconsciousness. The injuries were consistent with someone being punched in the face and then falling backward and downward against the machine's metal crank handle, with a projecting shaft tearing out some of her hair. Allegation: Mary Fagan was sexually assaulted before she died. Evidence: Dr. H.F. Harris's trial testimony confirmed that Fagan was bleeding from her vagina before she died. Quote, "On the walls of the vagina, there was evidence of violence of some kind. The dilation of the blood vessels indicated to me that the injury had been made in the vagina some little time before death. There was evidence of violence in the neighborhood of the hymen." Footnote 100. Dr. J.W. Hurd affirmed that, "It is my opinion that this enlargement of the vagina could have been produced by penetration immediately preceding death." Brief 46, Dr. Harris altered his testimony about Mary Fagan's hair months later during the appeals process. Allegation: the murder occurred at or about the time that Mary Fagan saw Leo Frank. Evidence: it is known that Mary ate cabbage a little before she left home to go to the factory that day. A chemical analysis of the progress and extent of digestion of the contents of Mary's stomach fixed the time of the murder at about the time that she met with Leo Frank. And there's a footnote. Testimony of Dr. Harris upheld by noted stomach specialists. And, as reported in AG, August 20th, 1913, three experts upheld Dr. Harris's testimony. So they are pretty reliably fixed what time she died. Prosecutor Hugh Dorsey brought his case to a Fulton County grand jury, and on May 24th, almost 1 month after the April 26th murder, Leo Frank was indicted for the murder of Mary Fagan. So within a month, they've got him indicted by a grand jury. The 23-member grand jury included five prominent members of the Jewish community, all of whom, according to an internal ADL document, had voted for the indictment of Leo Frank. Keep that in mind. That's something the Jews never mention when they talk about Leo Frank today. Like, even the Jews on this, five of the 23 grand jury were Jews, and they voted to indict the Jew because the evidence was pretty darn clear. They won't tell you that today. They won't put that in their parade musical. A couple of footnotes. 102. The grand jury is composed of many prominent and influential residents and businessmen. And then a list of all of them that I won't read. Let's see. Among the five Jews in the grand jury was Victor Hugo Kriegshaber, a merchant and manufacturer. He's at footnote 104. Oni, a different grand jury that also contained several Jews, considered the indictment of another black factory employer or employee named James Connolly. That was the fellow at the foot of the stairs, the janitor. Among them was the city's largest employer, Oscar Elsass, E-L-S-A-S, who was known to nurse a paranoid fixation with anti-Semitism, and who not only knew Frank, but was a client of Frank's attorney, Luther Rosser. See Clifford M. Kuhn, K-U-H-N, contesting the New South Order, the 1914-1915 strike in Atlanta's Fulton Mills. That's University of North Carolina Press, 2001. So there's Jews in the grand jury. Among them was Victor Hugo Kriegshaber, as said, a merchant and manufacturer who had been on the executive committees of both the National Conference of Jewish Charities and the Union of American Hebrew Congregations. All signed a bill of indictment, which read in part, "In the name and behalf of the citizens of Georgia, I charge and accuse Leo M. Frank with the offense of murder. With force and arms, did unlawfully and with malice aforethought, kill and murder one Mary Fagan by then and there choking her with a cord placed around her neck." Footnote 106, that's the bill of indictment in Fulton Superior Court in 1913. Newt Lee, they determined, would remain in custody. Again, that's the night watchman who came in later. The two blacks are the janitor and the night watchman. The janitor was there while this was going on. The night watchman came in hours later. Newt Lee, they determined, would remain in custody as a material witness. With this grand jury vote affirming his investigation, Prosecutor Dorsey confidently prepared for the trial of Leo Frank, which would grip Atlanta for the summer of 1913. Enter black man number two, James Connolly, and there's a picture of him inset. There are many pictures inset through this book. And go ahead and get it at Amazon or buy it direct from Nation of Islam yourself, if you like. While Prosecutor Dorsey prepared for trial, another figure emerged in the drama that had previously escaped almost everyone's notice. 27-year-old Jim Connolly had been employed at the factory for 2 years as an elevator operator and then as a sweeper. On May 1st, a week after the murder, the pencil company's day watchman, E.F. Holloway, claimed to have seen Connolly at the factory washing blood from his shirt. Connolly said that it was a rust stain he was cleaning, but Holloway called the police, who quickly took the black man into custody. Oddly, the idea that in the lynch mob South, a black murderer of a white girl would return to the scene of his crime a week later, not only wearing a blood-stained shirt, but also laundering it in front of white witnesses, did not seem absurd to investigators. According to the Georgian, one of the papers, the dailies, the police were inclined to attach little importance to this arrest, or to his arrest. So the first black they arrested would have been Newt Lee, the night watchman. He was the one who reported the crime. So now later, they're arresting Jim Connolly. What should have been a bombshell break of the case was met with a curiously subdued police and press reaction. Most puzzling, though, was the utter indifference of Leo Frank, then in jail, facing a capital murder charge. He and his team had proclaimed the murder to be a, quote, Negro crime, unquote. Yet the arrest of a bloody-shirted, washing Negro employee, which should have elicited cries of exoneration, aroused no excitement and induced not a single comment. An obviously counterfeited bloody shirt was clumsily planted in Newt Lee's home, the night watchman again, But here was an actual bloody shirt at the crime scene still worn by a black man. It is as if Conley had slipped into jail, where he sat anonymously under the radar for the next few weeks. It turns out that the stain on his shirt was in fact rust, but police continued to hold him anyway. James Conley was washing his shirt because he, like all the factory's employees, had been subpoenaed to appear at the coroner's inquest to tell what he knew about the events of the day of Mary Fagan's murder. Fulton County's no-nonsense coroner, Paul Donahue, D-O-N-E-H-O-O, Paul Donahue, had the power to question witnesses under oath to determine the cause and manner of death and to recommend indictment to a grand jury. It was the first official examination of the case, and all eyes were focused intently on the week-long event. But while in police custody, Conley missed the opportunity to testify. The arrest of Conley, just as the coroner's inquest was getting underway, and on the word of a Frank employee, demands a closer look, and the footnote there is 110 that reads, "It is curious that E.F. Holloway had provided investigators a couple of damning leads about two separate suspects, both of which benefited his employer, Leo Frank, and both of which turned out to be false." Like maybe he was paid to do it. In addition to information about Conley, Holloway provided, quote, "direct knowledge," unquote, that James Gant, the white former employee who returned to the pencil factory for his shoes, was, quote, "infatuated," unquote, with Fagan, and thus probably the murderer. See, charge is the basest of lies, declares Gant, accused, Atlanta, Georgia, on April 30th, 1913. According to trial testimony from factory superiors, the watchman who fingered Conley, E.F. Holloway, had actually been, quote, "detailed to maintain an espionage over Conley." He was part of a surveillance operation within the factory itself, showing that Leo Frank and his team were extremely interested in the 27-year-old, quote, "Negro sweeper," unquote, long before Holloway brought him to the attention of the Atlanta police. As Conley sat in jail, out of the public spotlight during the week-long inquest, scores of factory employees and other witnesses testified. The three Atlanta dailies parsing every nuance and speculating about every possible murder scenario. Coroner Donahue concluded his inquest on Thursday, May 8th, finding that there was enough evidence to charge both Leo Frank and Newt Lee. But Atlanta was stunned at what came next. Just days after the inquest, the forgotten sweeper, James Conley, was revealing a minutely detailed account of the events of April 26th, alleging that his white boss, suspect Leo Frank, was the murderer of Mary Fagan. Footnote 113 says, Conley swore out four affidavits. After leaking selective details of the story, Conley finally divulged the particulars of the murder and for many put all speculation to rest. Footnote 114 after that sentence reads, "It must be understood that at no point during the swearing of these affidavits did Conley have an attorney representing his interests." So he told the story in parts, and they kept getting more and more out of him. He was trying to lie, then he gave it up and slowly told the truth. And he didn't have an attorney. Today, that fact alone would disqualify those statements as evidence. Indeed, one of the affidavits was unsigned. Later in court, an attorney appeared on his behalf, but as will be discussed later, William Smith would be found to have serious conflicts of interest. He said that by prearrangement, made the previous day on April 25th, that'd be Friday, Frank met him at the factory on that holiday morning. Frank had offered to employ him, not to sweep as usual, but to sit in the first floor stairwell as a lookout as he, Frank, had a private rendezvous with an unnamed woman just upstairs in his second floor office. Remember what I said, there's a door on this. You come on the first floor, there's stairs up to the second floor, and midway on the stairs is a door that can be locked. So black guy janitor sweeper Conley can sit there on a chair near the stairs and, you know, lock or unlock the door, according to his boss Jew Leo Frank, stamping his feet. That's how they worked it. And he'd had women there before. It was a role Conley claimed to have performed for Frank several times. When The 29-year-old Jew, who was married, used his office for trysts with women other than his wife. So he knows exactly what he's doing. Remember, he's 29 and Mary Fagan is 13. So he's telling the black guy, look, just I'll stamp my foot. That means you lock the door. And then when I'm ready to let her out again, I'll stamp my foot and you let the woman back out when it went correctly. If Mary had agreed to this tryst, he would have, you know, had sex with her. And then she would have come out later on and he would have let her back out. It was a role Conley claimed to have performed for Frank several times, when Frank used his office for trysts with women other than his wife. And he's married to a Jew. He's the head of the B'nai B'rith, and this is how he acts. Debauching white women is his fun and his hobby. According to Conley, when Mary Fagan arrived for her pay a little after noon, he saw her go up the stairs on her way to Frank's office. While in his position at the first floor stairwell, Conley says he heard two sets of footprints go from Frank's office to the rear of the second floor, but then heard a scream and only one set of steps return. Moments later, a visibly shaken Leo Frank signaled Conley to come upstairs and directed him to the back room where Conley discovered the girl's body, bloodied and lifeless, and with a cord tightly wrapped around her neck. Frank explained that he had tried to have sex with the girl, but when she resisted, he struck her, leading to her accidental and tragic demise. Conley's account was rich enough with significant details to startle the police by its accuracy. His narrative of that day's events corresponded to the physical evidence police had collected, and with the accounts of the other witnesses, and most important for investigators, a motive came into full view. Conley said that Frank then ordered him to carry the body to the basement, but it was too heavy for him to carry alone. He asked Frank, she was fairly thick, not fat, but like apparently fairly solidly built, 13-year-old. He asked Frank for help because she was too heavy for him to carry alone, and using the elevator, they both moved Mary's body and effects and then returned to Frank's second floor office. Once there, the nervous factory superintendent gave Conley a pad of paper and ordered him to write out the four separate notes, two of which would eventually be found by the police next to the body. The two notes became the feature of the case that most flummoxed investigators. The cryptic language suggested they were written by the suffering victim who, in her last breaths, scrawled the identity of her killer. But they were written in rather unconvincing Negro dialect, with misspellings intended to suggest the writer was an uneducated black man. The first note read, quote, he said he would love me, would, W-O-O-D, and land down play like Night Witch did it, but that long, tall, black Negro did by his slef. And that's the first note. And the second was more descriptive, direct quote. Ma'am, that Negro higher down here did this. I went to make water, and he pushed me down that hole, a long, tall, Negro, black, that who, H-O-O, it was, W-A-S-E, long, sleam, S-L-E-A-M, tall, Negro, I write, with a W, while play with me. The ruse fooled no one, in that Mary herself was never considered the author, and the police naturally deduced that the slayer had to be the author. This is, again, Leo Frank, who murdered her, telling this black to write these two notes to fake out the police, but it didn't work. It was generally assumed in the post-slavery South that all blacks were unable to read or write, the calculated result of Jim Crow racism, so the presence of notes and the rather complex intent of the message made it impossible to classify Mary Fagan's death as a typical Negro crime, quote-unquote. When James Conley was arrested, he denied he could read or write, but police found out through some pawn shop receipts he had signed that the factory sweeper could indeed write, and they began to increase the pressure on him. I wrote those notes, Conley would later testify in court. Mr. Frank had me write them. I didn't know what he wanted with them, and he gave me some money to do it. Footnote 118 reads, Conley testified that Frank had given him a wad of bills that Frank told him was $200, but then Frank rethought the payment and took the money back, instead giving him $2.50, $2.50, a nearly 100% pay cut. He said that Frank concocted the notes to pin the crime on a black man. He made the cold-hearted comment as he did that, "Why should I hang? I have wealthy people in Brooklyn." Footnote 119, a long one. It was denied by some that Frank's relatives were rich at all. Frank's attorney, Reuben Arnold, stated in court that, quote, "We overwhelmingly showed that he did not have wealthy relatives there. His people are of very limited means. His father was a traveling salesman with an income of $1,200 a year. He is old and crippled now, and trouble is his portion." The trial of Leo Frank, Reuben R. Arnold's address to the court in his behalf, Baxley, Georgia, classic 1959. But Frank's own appeals attorney, Lewis Marshall, said in a private letter, the number one most important Jew in the U.S. back then, "Frank's uncle is a man of means and has been very generous in meeting the necessary expenses," Lewis Marshall said. Years later, Marshall seemed to deny his first statement when he wrote, "Even the ordinary expenses were paid for out of my own pocket." Also, the Atlanta Georgian of May 2, 1913, reports that Frank's uncle is very wealthy. In fact, Moses Frank was a major operator in the international cottonseed oil business, one of many, many Jewish businessmen profiting from African slave labor. See Lynette Boney Wren, Cinderella of the New South, A History of the Cottonseed Industry, 1855 to 1955. That's University of Tennessee Press, 1995. And again, Atlanta Journal. "It was learned Thursday that Moses Frank, one of the city's most substantial citizens, is returning to Atlanta today to assist his nephew, L.M. Frank," Leo Max Frank, "is said to be a favorite nephew and the probable heir to his fortune." So the Jews are lying and lying and lying about this. Try to say, "Oh, he's rich. Oh, he's not rich. Oh, he's rich." And saying different things at different times. But that's what the black the Jew tried to frame said that the Jew, Leo Max Frank, the murderer, said at the time of the murder, or at the time of the note writing, "Why should I hang? I have wealthy people in Brooklyn," said Leo Max Frank, the murderer, the rapist, and the pedophile who tried to frame two different blacks for his crime. Frank then ordered Conley to return later that afternoon to burn the body in the factory furnace. Conley agreed, but he never returned, later saying he was too scared and went home to stay. And so for about 15 hours, the body remained in that basement where night watchman Newt Lee found it early the next morning. Like, I think 2 or 3 a.m. he found it. So it's already been sitting there since, you know, a little afternoon. Asked why he had released the story gradually, giving the appearance that he was lying, Conley said that he had tried to cover up for his employer by sticking with their prearranged story. Quote, "I didn't tell the whole truth then because I didn't want to give the whole thing away then." As Frank came under more and more police pressure, his public claims that Mary's demise was a, quote, "Negro crime" sounded to Conley as if Frank was getting ready to pin the murder on him, causing Conley finally to confess to his accessory after the fact role. His statement was recorded in the Atlanta Constitution. Long quotes here. This is Jim Conley in his actual statement. "It's the truth, though, the whole truth, and I hope to God that he strikes me dead this very instance, if it ain't. I was intended not to tell the whole business. I was fixing to take care of Mr. Frank like he told me to in the first place. I was going to keep my mouth shut and say nothing. Until some of those folks down at the pencil factory opens up and begins trying to make out that I killed the little girl. And that I'm trying to save my own neck by fixing it on Mr. Frank. That made me mad. It didn't make me any madder than it made me scared. I just put it down that if I didn't come out with the truth, they would get me and hang an innocent nigger. This is one innocent nigger that doesn't want to be hanged." I put that in there myself. He didn't say it. "I called for Mr. Detective Black that Saturday and begins to open up. I was afraid even then, though, to tell the whole business. Finally, the thing got to working in my head so much that I just couldn't hold it any longer. I couldn't sleep, and it worried me mightily. I just decided it was time for me to come on out with it, and I did. the detectives and Chief Lanford treated me mighty fair, and I felt a whole lot better when I went up before them and told the truth. I don't think I slept better in a long time than I slept last night. I knew I had told the truth, and I felt like a clean nigger. They won't do much with me, I don't think. Mr. Hugh Dorsey, he came a long time ago when I first started to open up, and he told me everything was all right, and for me to go ahead with everything I knew. So he made a clean nigger breast of it. Finally. Turning on to 59, or across to it. Meanwhile, Leo Frank was sitting in the Atlanta City Jail, still denying any knowledge of Mary Fagan's murder. But as soon as the Connolly bombshell statement became known, a reporter hurried down to get Frank's reaction, and it was truly striking. Block quote. "What have you to say to this?" demanded a Georgian reporter. Frank, as soon as he gained the import of what the Negro had told, jumped back in his cell and refused to say a word. His hands moved nervously and his face twitched as though he were on the verge of a breakdown, but he absolutely declined to deny the truth of the Negro statement or to make any sort of comment upon it. His only answer to the repeated questions that were shot at him was a negative shaking of the head, or the reply, "I have nothing to say." He can't deny it because he knows that it's true. Once Frank recovered and regrouped, the lawyered-up defendant made a full-throated denial and countercharge that, quote, the Negro Connolly, unquote, was the real murderer. Well, what else can he do at that point? And for the first time in American history, the word of a wealthy and well-connected white businessman, sick, a Jew businessman, was being openly defied and disputed by a poor working-class black laborer in a court proceeding. Each accused the other of a most heinous crime, and there was no middle ground. One of the two, Leo Frank or Jim Connolly, would face certain death at the end of a hangman's rope. The fact that a, quote, Negro charged a white man with murder, that act itself being a lynchable crime in America, stunned Atlanta, sending newspapers into multiple editions. Connolly's confession of his role in the cover-up provided the state with its first actual witness to the crime and added an explosive new racial dynamic. It set the stage for the first major courtroom confrontation in the history of blacks and Jews in America. Footnote 124, blacks and Jews had, of course, many confrontations in other areas throughout the slavery and Jim Crow era. See The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, Volumes number 1 and number 2. Jews Selling Blacks, Slave Sale Advertising by American Jews. That was Volume 2. As the facts unfolded, it became clear to all that only Frank or Connolly could have sexually attacked and murdered Mary Fagan. The only third option was that they had collaborated equally, meaning they both would hang. The historical odds were plainly stacked against the black man, but the Georgia prosecutors, in the state that led the nation in lynchings, would take their case to an all-white male Southern jury, asserting that Leo Frank, the white man, sick, the Jew, had committed the murder, and that Connolly's version of events was the legal truth. If the scenario described by Connolly had any truth in it, that some collaboration existed between him and Leo Frank, then the fortuitously timed arrest of Connolly to keep him from being aggressively questioned at the coroner's inquest may have been yet another strategic move by Frank's forces, a move they now saw that had backfired. The Frank Connolly stare down. Frank blinks. The pure uniqueness of the Connolly-Frank courtroom drama must be viewed in full American racial context. In the post-slavery South, a black man, woman, or child who talked back, in italics, to a white man was considered suicidal. A black man accusing a white man of any crime, much less that of murder, was uncharted racial territory. Not uncharted in terms of whether he would face a public execution, that was assured. Just how many of the man's family, friends, and neighbors might be collaterally slaughtered was the only unknown in the equation. Collective punishments, including wholesale massacres of blacks for the slightest perceived offenses, had become part and parcel of American race relations. In 1955, more than four decades after Mary Fagan's murder, a black man named Mose Wright stood in a Mississippi court, and when asked to identify the white man he saw kidnap his murdered nephew Emmett Till, he pointed to the white man and said in common black country vernacular, "Dar he, there he is." For that simple testimony, the 64-year-old Wright had to instantaneously leave Mississippi for good. Historian W. Fitzhugh Brundage reports that one quarter of Georgia's reported mass mob lynchings involved, quote, torture, quote, mutilation, and, quote, grisly ceremonies. None of the black victims of this gruesome system of white, quote, justice had even been charged with the acts that James Connolly was now openly admitting to. That's footnote 126. W. Fitzhugh Brundage, Brundage, Lynching in the New South, Georgia and Virginia, 1880 to 1930. That's University of Illinois Press, 1993. Further, it was considered racial heresy for a white man to allow such black insolence to go unpunished, in that it was feared that such a display of black boldness would threaten the entire superstructure of white supremacy. Such a black man had to be forcibly put down, lest he, quote, infect with his audacity, unquote, everyone else's Negro property. And as we see, as I'm speaking, the blacks are ripping down statues all over the country. We see they are easily infected with audacity, and these people were right. You have to keep a tight control over blacks in order to prevent their animal nature from resounding in a most uncivilized way. All whites live by this code without exception, and blacks, of course, had no option but to abide. But when Leo Frank was given the responsibility, in italics, of, when I emphasize it means italics that the NOI is adding, when Leo Frank was given the responsibility of confronting Connolly face to face in the presence of white men of standing, Frank declined, claiming instead that he needed a specific one of his many lawyers to be present who was then out of town. But attorney Luther Rosser was soon returned, and Frank still avoided the head-to-head with Connolly. So this really is unprecedented that a white man isn't immediately saying, that nigger is goddamn lying, when he's confronted like this. So as we've seen, he's a guilty, quavering, little, nasty little Jew. American courtroom procedures have evolved in some respects since the 1910s, but in 1913, the age-old right to face one's accuser had not yet been confined to a courtroom procedure. And in the Southern society in which Frank lived and thrived, this kind of extrajudicial confrontation was as common as an arraignment is today. So the court was kind of like the last, not so much the last resort, but they had no problem. Well, today it would be denounced as taking the law into your own hands, but then it was being manly and doing what was responsible. Rather than sitting around watching football, they would take justice, and they would see that honor was upheld. In Georgia, more than anywhere else, it sounds like. Chief of Detectives Newport A. Lanford made every attempt to arrange a Connolly-Frank encounter in the presence of the grand jury, not in the police station, the jail, or any environment to which Leo Frank might object. Footnote 129. See also Connolly insists on facing Frank. Connolly begs Chief to let him repeat a story before Frank. Frank asked room to conceal body, believes Lanford. And the Washington Post, there's a quote from Chief Lanford, sick, because it's Lanford, also charged today that Sheriff C. Wheeler Mangum allows friends of Frank to visit him, but flatly refuses to allow men working on the case to see him or talk with him. See, a Jew's getting special privilege and special treatment, even back then. The city detective department is anxious to confront Frank with Connolly, but Sheriff Mangum has refused to admit these detectives and the Negro to Frank's cell. Chief Lanford stated today that, contrary to assisting us in this case, it appears to me that Sheriff Mangum has placed obstacles in our way. Back to the text. But according to the Constitution, the Atlanta Constitution paper, when word came to Frank that the police chiefs and the Pinkerton man desired to confront him with Conley, the prisoner positively refused them an audience. His refusal to confront Conley amounted to sacrilege, a grievous offense, and for many Georgians it was akin to a guilty plea. Long footnote 131. This was a cultural holdover from the slavery era when the master, quote-unquote, of every black slave acted as his guardian in any conflict or interaction with other whites or with the human property of other whites. After slavery, this role fell to the employer, who was expected to help authorities maintain white supremacy in all affairs concerning his, quote, Negro property. Newt Lee's previous employer, T.Y. Brent, took part in the police, quote, interrogation of Lee, as did the Frank-fired factory employer and then-suspect James Gant, who was white. See Atlanta Constitution. Brent would later join the Frank defense team and play an important role in the trial. See section herein entitled Injecting Anti-Semitism into the Trial, colon, the Brent-Kendley Affair, K-E-N-D-L-E-Y. Yet another way in which the Jews try to pervert the course of justice. So really, there's not really any factual doubt about what happens, which makes it all the more white genocidally chutzpathic that they claim 100 years later that their pedophile rapist murderer, their 29-year-old head of B'nai B'rith, their great respectable man who likes to go after young white girls, 13-year-olds, is innocent when in fact he's guilty and there's no doubt about it whatsoever. They lie that there's doubt about him being guilty, and they lie about him being guilty. And both of those are absurd. It's absolutely clear-cut what happened. And the text, so when Leo Frank won't face this black, people are like, oh, wow. So the nigger is telling the truth, and this nasty little kike is lying. He's guilty. Everything bespeaks his guilt. His body language, his refusal to confront someone who's accusing him. He is guilty. And for many Georgians, it was akin to a guilty plea, his refusal to face Frank directly and immediately, or to face Conley. For his part, the Negro James Conley matched Frank's meekness with a startling chutzpah and was openly and publicly demanding the confrontation. The Georgian reported, I'm anxious to face Mr. Frank and tell my story to his face. There's a footnote there. Conley of late has insisted upon facing Frank, declaring that if he can confront the white man with his story, he will obtain admission. Chief of Detectives N.A. Lanford seemed powerless to make it happen. We can't get to see Frank ourselves, said Jewish obstructionism, even back then. None of our men can see him. It seems impossible to have Conley get to him. The prosecutor made a telling point in the common language of white supremacy, a language that Frank and Atlanta's Jewish community spoke fluently. Quote, I tell you, gentlemen of the jury, measuring my words as I utter them, and if you have got sense enough to get out of a shower of rain, you know it's true, that never in the history of the Anglo-Saxon race, never in the history of the African race in America, never in the history of any other race did an ignorant, filthy Negro accuse a white man of a crime, and that man declined to face him. It's Prosecutor Hugh M. Dorsey continuing. And there never lived within the state of Georgia a lawyer with one half the ability of Mr. Luther Rosser, one of Frank's lawyers and a very famous great lawyer, who possessed a consciousness of his client's innocence that wouldn't have said, let this ignorant Negro confront my innocent client. If there be a Negro who accuses me of a crime of which I am innocent, I tell you, and you know it's true, says Dorsey, I'm going to confront him even before my attorney, no matter who he is. Returns from Tallulah Falls, and if not, then I tell you, just as soon as that attorney does return, I'm going to see that Negro is brought into my presence and permitted to set forth his accusations. So this is white, they're calling it white supremacy, but it's just honor-based civilization, like confronting your accuser. A very basic premise of Anglo-Saxon law. It was not as if Frank could claim to be Well, that was 133. Let's see if there's anything. Argument of Hugh Dorsey, 99-100. Sheriff C. Wheeler Mangum testified that Frank refused to see Conley when he was brought to Frank's jail cell. Frank's lawyer objected to the incident being brought out at trial, and Dorsey explained to the court, quote, "I want to show that for the first time in the history of the white race, a white man claiming innocence refused to confront his accuser, and particularly that this accuser was only an ignorant Negro." The paper then reported that, quote, "Judge Roan sustained the state." That's a valid point to make, and he's allowed to make it. Now back to the text. It's not as if Frank could claim to be upholding some higher legal principle. Frank, though in custody himself, was asked to confront Newt Lee because, said an investigator, "I thought he could get more out of the nigger than we could." You remember that from earlier. Of course, he knows the night watchman came in afterwards and doesn't know what happened because he wasn't there. Frank willingly performed the, quote, "interrogation of Lee without hesitation or request for the presence of his lawyers." That the request by law should go through Lee's attorney is not even an idea worthy of consideration by police officials. So, I mean, they're correctly pointing out that blacks are absolutely treated as well beneath serious white citizens, which is how a civilized society would do it, if they had to have any blacks around in the first place. Frank's lead attorney, deep southerner Luther Ziegler, Z-E-I-G-L-E-R, possibly Ziegler, Luther Ziegler or Ziegler Rosser, had no choice but to defend his client by sinking even deeper into the swamp, calling the act of confronting Conley, quote, "a dirty farce with a dirty Negro." So they're going to sully this black's reputation. They're going to do anything they can, from lying to framing to murder to acts of physical violence, to get this Jew pedophile rapist murderer off. That's how Jews are. That's the true bottom line to all this. This is an absolutely rotten race that never stops lying. It lies across generations. There's never an honest Jew who comes to, "Oh yeah, our guy was guilty." For over 100 years, they've been promoting this guy's innocent when it is absolutely 100% black and white that Leo Frank was guilty. And that's your takeaway. This is literally a genetic race of liars. It's their culture. It's in their seed. It's what comes out of their balls. It's what's in the eggs in their womb. They are a race of goddamn liars. And they are bent on our genocide. Think about that. It's the perfect one-man microcosm of the so-called Holocaust macrocosm. Everything Jews do is a goddamn lie. Aimed at us, at our families, at our daughters, like Mary Fagan, at our mothers and sisters and brothers and cousins. They are a race that wants to exterminate whites. And this proves how evil and how full of lies they are. If they would lie about this, they would absolutely lie about anything. And indeed, that is their whole history, is a tribe of liars. It hates every other and tries to kill it. And if it does kill off another kind of people, it creates a holiday out of that genocide. That's what Jews are. And this people controls our politics and our media. How about that? Pretty dangerous situation, wouldn't you say? And we're on page 64 now. Whatever racial rarities the case now presented, James Connolly's story was convincing. His description of the particulars of the crime scene, too detailed to have been spun from whole cloth. He ain't making this up. When Conley was brought to the scene of the crime to reenact his story, he left the several white witnesses awestruck. A reporter from the Atlanta Georgian described how Conley's account and demeanor affected those who witnessed the reenactment. The Negro appeared to be telling a straightforward story and was ready with an answer whenever any of the officers asked him a question. The Negro went through the terrible tragedy movement by movement without faltering for an instant or hesitating as though he were not sure of his ground. Conley appeared perfectly composed as though he were reciting an everyday occurrence, but his earnest and apparently truthful bearing gave his dramatic story, told in a matter-of-fact way, a convincing power that evidently had its effect on everyone who was listening to his recital. He did not hesitate for a moment, during the entire time he was showing his part in the crime, and his frankness of speech and clock-like work impressed the officers that he was, at last, telling the exact truth. Footnote 136, dramatic scene at factory as Conley reenacts crime. Later, another Georgian reporter affirmed that account, block quote, in the footnote. The Negro proved himself either a most consummate actor or a man who was finally telling the truth. He was letter perfect, so far as a person could be in a tragedy of the sort. He never faltered nor hesitated, yet he reproduced in startling detail every movement and every conversation of importance which he said took place. If he was lying, it was a most amazing fabrication he built up. He told more than enough to demonstrate conclusively that he knew all about the disposal of the body. The detectives were forced to feel that they were witnessing an almost exact reproduction of what took place after Mary Fagan was killed the afternoon of April 26th. So, the black is quite believable. And at trial, another quote, Conley testified with dramatic rapidity. He repeated the alleged conversations with Frank verbatim. At no time did he display any uncertainty. And then we flip on to 65 or across to it. Graphic, Conley's pantomime illustration of gruesome part he played in Fagan case. And showing the different stations they were and how it was done. This diagram, this is from Atlanta Journal, August 4th, 1913. This diagram is reproduced so that readers can compare the Negro's story, as he told it on the stand, with his pantomime illustration of the crime in the presence of officers some weeks ago. In numerical sequence, the reader can follow on this diagram the movements of the Negro sweeper, Jim Conley, C-O-N-L-E-Y, at the National Pencil Factory on the day of Mary Fagan's murder, as the Negro described them to the police, and then reenacted them before the eyes of the police at the factory itself. I'll read through these. I think this is worth reading. One, this is still part of the diagram. So they show there's one, two, three floors, and they show you the various stations, the elevator, and you know they drag the body back and forth. One, Conley sits dozing and half-sodden with whiskey and beer on boxes beside the stairway in gloom, right below the where she would go up on the first floor to the second floor. Two, he answers Mr. Frank's call, and Mr. Frank meets him at the head of the stairs and sends him back. Back to three, to pick up the girl who has, quote, hit her head against something, unquote. Beyond the girl's body is the women's lavatory. Quote, a machine where a strand of hair was found Monday after the murder. Four, Negro goes after crocus bagging to wrap body in. Five, carries body toward front on his shoulder. Six, it slips from his shoulder and falls to the floor. This is the spot where workers in the factory noticed blood 2 days later when they came back to work, and where detectives chipped wood from the floor for analysis. Seven, Mr. Frank, having come to help the Negro after he dropped the body, is so nervous himself that the feet slip from his hands and fall to the floor. Eight, they carry the body between them to the elevator. Nine, they descend in the elevator, Mr. Frank running it, standing astride the girl's feet. Ten, the Negro shoulders the body again, Mr. Frank climbing the ladder to the trap door. Eleven, to watch the entrance and the basement both from there. 12, the Negro puts the body down around the corner at the partition's end. Cross marks where Newt Lee was standing with his lantern when he spied the body over 12 hours later. arrow points to the back door found closed with a hasp pulled out and the lock in, so no one could accidentally or whatever by purpose come in through that odd bottom opening. 13. Negro throws girl's hat and ribbon and shoe and the stained crocus sack upon trash pile in front of the furnace at Mr. Frank's direction. Then Negro runs elevator back up, Mr. Frank jumping aboard as car passes street floor, and both emerge at second floor, Mr. Frank going around behind the elevator to sink and washing his hands there. Or 14, and washing his hands there. Time clock that faces elevator shaft is shown through it. 15, Mr. Frank sits at desk. And 16, Negro sits at table writing notes. They hear someone coming, and Negro is hid in the wardrobe. So the person coming, maybe for pay or something, wouldn't see that they were together. So that was a layout in one of the three dailies back in August 4th, 1913. Conley's on-scene account corroborated and added a crucial detail to the prosecution's theory of the crime, and it had a devastating effect on Leo Frank's alibi. By this time, the Frank team's dogged pursuit of Newt Lee had no takers among both the press and the investigators, who now were convinced that the night watchman was an innocent victim of a, quote, frame-up. For many, the pretrial coup de grace came when Picardy detective Harry Scott broke cleanly from the Frank camp with these words, quote, "There is not a doubt that the Negro, Conley, is telling the truth, and it would be foolish to doubt it. The Negro couldn't go through the actions like he did unless he had done this just like he said. We believe that we have at last gotten to the bottom of the Fagan mystery. Conley's confession fits exactly in with our theory." And it's footnote 138. Conley reenacts in plant part he says he took in slaying. Quote, "That the sweeper is telling the unadulterated truth is the opinion of headquarters detectives and Superintendent Harry Scott of the Pinkertons." So the cops believe he's telling the truth and are willing to say that. While Georgians had given the benefit of the doubt to Frank as a fellow white man, the weight of Conley's account put their doubts to rest. He had an incredible story to tell, and it was becoming clearer to Atlantans following the case that Leo Frank and his legal team were not as surprised about James Conley as they claimed to be. This growing suspicion put Frank's advocates in a precarious position. Winning the case now required more than simple denials. They would have to set their sights entirely on the destruction of the black man, James Conley. Next section, Leo Frank builds a Negro defense. Two epigraphs. Was he really guilty? I studied all I could, and I still can't figure it out. Dr. Jeffrey Melnick, footnote 139. The complicated story of Leo Frank's trial and lynching. Black Jewish relations on trial that you just can't figure it out. Just like OJ. And then again, I think there was a reasonable case against Leo Frank, said Steve Oney, who wrote one of the books. I mean, he's conceding that, but there's not a reasonable case. There's an overwhelming, undeniable 100% case. And that's 100 years after Leo Frank case still raises questions. Interview by Steve Goss, one-on-one with Steve Goss, September 30th, 2013. Now, it's not still raising questions. The only question still raised is, how can Jews lie about this 100 years after the fact? And the answer to that is known as well. I just gave it to you a little while ago. Since the murder of Mary Fagan on April 26, 1913, Frank's theory of the crime was a moving target. He at first claimed he did not know Mary Fagan and pointed to the employee he had fired, James Gant, who had visited the factory that Saturday looking for his shoes. But when Frank told police that Gant had had a romantic interest in the victim, he in effect confirmed that he did indeed know Mary Fagan. So this Jew is terrible at lying. Thus, he drew more suspicion to himself rather than to Gant, who was soon released from custody. But Gant's presence at the factory had another unintended consequence, which severely limited Frank's alibi options. James Gant arrived at 6 p.m., just after night watchman Newt Lee returned to the factory, and just as Frank was leaving for the day. 2 hours earlier, Lee had arrived as scheduled at 4 p.m., but Frank inexplicably sent him away, telling him to return at 6. With the three having met in the front hallway area, Gant became the only white man who could corroborate that Newt Lee had actually seen Leo Frank. He thus foiled any plans Frank may have had to create a false itinerary for Lee or for himself, or deny knowledge of Lee's movements. Frank could have insisted that Lee, who had a key to the factory, had come even earlier than 4 p.m., closer to the time of the murder, and no one but Newt Lee, a, quote, long, slim, tall Negro, as described in the murder notes, would have been any wiser. Frank's startled reaction upon seeing Gant at the factory at 6 p.m., the night of the murder, may have been, in part, a realization that engineering Newt Lee's conviction would be far more challenging. Graphic: Mary Fagan's murder was work of a Negro, declares Leo M. Frank. That's the Atlanta Constitution headline, May 31st, 1913. Still, the Frank team pressed police to indict the friendless night watchman, even clumsily planting evidence to, quote, help the police with their investigation. But Lee's steadfast and unwavering self-defense beat back the lynch mobs and cleared him in the minds of Atlantans. And though Lee continued to be jailed during the trial, most suspicion in the popular mind shifted firmly to Leo Frank. Abandoning their attempts to implicate Newt Lee, Frank's legal team moved to target the second black man, James Conley. Conley's late May confession upset the dynamics of the case and Frank's legal approach to it. Without Conley, the state's case was compelling but not fully convincing. The integrity, connections, and whiteness of the defendant and the youth, and the youth, gender, and lower economic status of the victim, conspired to give the legal advantage to Leo Frank. If Frank simply continued to maintain that he had no knowledge of the crime, his high-octane legal team could very likely achieve an acquittal. Conley's detailed account, however, forced Frank into a position that required he provide specific explanations, not general denials. If Conley testified in court as convincingly as he had in public, the jury would need more than a simple claim of ignorance to acquit Leo Frank. The defense's response was to attack Conley, first as a Negro, then as a person of bad moral character, and obliterate his claims about Frank being the murderer of Mary Fagan. They countercharged that, quote, the Negro Conley was the lone murderer whose motive was straight robbery. It was simple, they said. A drunken James Conley entered the building about 9:40 a.m. in pursuit of Miss Maddie Smith, who came to collect her pay. Conley lay in wait with the intention of robbing her, but he was deterred when she came down the stairs with factory personnel manager N.V. Darley. Frank's defense team, quote, later he saw little Mary Fagan come in and waited until she came down. Then he grabbed her and tried to get her purse. A scuffle by the elevator ensued, and the Negro knocked the girl down the elevator shaft to the basement. He quickly followed her down, going down by the trap door. He found her cut and bruised and unconscious. Then he tied the cord around her neck and choked her to death. He wrote the notes himself, and then he pulled the staple off the rear basement door and left the place. That murder scenario was followed up with a description of Conley's character that made him the obvious suspect. Block quote, is it not more reasonable that Mary Fagan, passing down the stairway out of the factory from the office floor to the street floor, came down the very stairway near where Conley was lurking in the darkness under the influence of liquor, passions aroused, and hard up for money, was set upon the girl and thrust down the trapdoor to the basement? As the murder note sets forth, Conley follows her down and completes her undoing and accomplishes her death, breaks the alley door of the basement, and escapes from the building. Attorney Reuben Arnold elaborated at trial, quote, it was the crime of a savage Negro whose first attack is violence because he cannot accomplish his object in any other way. He added, "We don't know how long it took the nigger to kill the child." Frank's defense team relied on this theory at trial, and it has been more or less the root theory that for a century has satisfied numerous case analysts. But to accept this theory and its embellishments in any meaningful way, one must necessarily reconcile it with an implausible set of assumptions. For instance, one must believe, and there's about five bullet points. First bullet point, one must believe, for this to be true, that a 27-year-old black man who lives in 1913 Georgia, a state that led the nation in premeditated, wanton, and cold-blooded public murders of black men, lynchings preceded by ghastly tortures, burnings alive and living dismemberments, castrations and amputations, would target for robbery an adolescent white girl, then rape and murder her, hide her body at their workplace, and then write notes about it. Second bullet point, then one has to believe that on his day off, Conley would choose his place of long-term employment to perpetrate the crime of robbery against fellow employees, knowing that his fastidious white boss was only a few feet away and that other white men were on the floors above, within a few feet of an open front door, through which many other white people, employees and non-employees, were regularly entering and exiting. A third bullet point, that Conley, you'd have to believe that Conley, after allegedly committing the murder, made no effort to flee the state. Instead, as testimony would show, he gets some food, relaxes at home, and then returns to the scene of Saturday's crime at his usual time for work on Monday. You'd have to believe, fourth bullet point, that having no history of robbery, rape, or murder, Conley would prefer to rob Mary Fagan of $1.20 when he only had to ask Frank or any of the other employees to advance him money. And Frank and Conley's co-workers had done so willingly several times. Frank even seemed to have become Conley's own personal banker. That's footnote 146. Conley was not the only one. On the day of the murder, Frank advanced money, $2, to Arthur White upon his request. Final bullet point, you'd have to believe that even if Conley were intent on robbery, he would choose a young 13-year-old girl who held one of the lowest-paying jobs of the workforce, and that he would think her to be a better target than Leo Frank, who was alone in his office only 20 to 25 feet away, and who Conley knew possessed on his person and in his safe maybe hundreds, if not thousands, of company payroll dollars. Several other employees were in the factory that morning, all of whom, in positions or with incomes higher than those of either Mattie Smith or Mary Fagan, and all at best passed by Conley unmolested. So none of it adds up in the slightest. This is what the Jews are reduced to claiming. Conley would have been the only black man in Western Hemispheric history who expected he could get away with such a crime. Jewish scholar Harry Simonhoff, H-O-F-F, admitted, "The Georgian custom took care of a Negro rapist without bothering about a trial. One could face a horrifying demise for complaining about wages, for having land or crops that a white man coveted, even for pursuing an education, or for not answering a white man with the requisite inflections of submission. It is far, far more likely that a white male factory owner who employed dozens of adolescent girls and had a history of extramarital sexual relations, a fact admitted by Frank's defense, would use his authoritative position to gain sexual advantage over the females he hired. Not only is it an entirely conceivable scenario, but it is an accurate subtext of America's industrial expansion. Black American women, North and South, had been continual victims of this kind of white male exploitation for centuries, to such a degree that white male rapists produced an entirely new race they called mulattoes, the living evidence of the frequency of this fiendish behavior." Except how much of it was actual rape and how much of it was welcomed. As historian Nell Painter stated in the television production The People vs. Leo Frank, one of the prime complaints of women in the workforce was their being preyed upon by men. It is impossible for those predators to have been black men. In reality, an extraordinary set of facts, indeed a mountain of evidence pointing to Frank's guilt, had to be enforced for Conley to escape the legendary Southern lust for black blood. Frank's theory falters for all those obvious reasons, But Frank's own testimony negates his own murder scenario, implicating the Negro Connelly, quote-unquote. Just 2 days after the murder, the Atlanta Georgian quotes a not-yet-arrested Leo Frank. Mary Fagan went out through the outer office, and I heard her talking to another girl. While I could not swear that they went out of the building, I am quite sure they did, for I would have noticed anyone moving about the building. Frank's fresh, unfiltered, and unlawyered recollection negates his later charges of robbery and tends to clear James Connelly. In fact, the Georgian reported that at 12:10 p.m. Saturday, Mary Fagan appeared at the National Pencil Factory, drew the pay due her, and, quote, chatted a few minutes with friends. The manager is sure she then left the building. Months later, when giving his statement in court, Frank is less definite. She continued on her way out, he says, and I heard the sound of her footsteps as she went away. It was a few moments after she asked me this question that I had an impression of a female voice saying something, I don't know which way it came from, just passed away and I had that impression. Frank's continually changing accounts of his critical encounter with Mary Fagan stood feebly next to the testament of Connelly, which by comparison appeared to be set in stone. Circumstances had now forced Frank's legal team to press forward with their racist insistence that the murder was a, quote, Negro crime, and that consequently a, quote, Negro, unquote, must be held accountable. But Frank's theory was about to take another blow with the introduction of yet another white witness whose experience at the factory that day severely weakened Frank's latest alibi and gave Connelly's account another boost of believability. On to page 73, there's a diagram again published in the Atlanta Georgian on August 12, 1913. Diagram of theory as advanced by defense. And they're showing, you know, him pushing her down and walking down the elevator. The defense's theory of the killing of Mary Fagan is that the little girl, after leaving Frank's office unmolested, was seized by the Negro Connelly at the foot of the stairs, crowded back into the rear room, and there battered into insensibility, if not instant death, after which she was dragged to the trapdoor in the extreme rear and thrown into the cellar below. Later, the Negro went into the cellar, placed a cord around the girl's neck, and drew it very tight, perhaps thus snuffing out the last fluttering breath of life in the insensible, this word for unconscious, body. The motive assigned to the Negro is robbery. And then some pictures on 74 and 75. The New York Times, owned by Adolph Oakes, O-C-H-S, or Ox, staged a photo reenactment of Leo Frank's version of the murder of Mary Fagan, using a white actor in blackface to play the part of James Connelly. So the Jews are reenacting this crime to try to get their fellow off. The Northern paper, the number one Jewish paper in the country, is trying to get Leo Frank off, using whites in blackface to reenact some bullshit story that never happened. But if you see that, it could be quite plausible, eh? These stage photos have little basis in fact, but were submitted to Governor Slayton by Frank's legal team in his 1915 commutation hearing. It was a desperate attempt to inflame Southern white male passions against James Connelly. You know, they make things up using spurious photos or moving images like Schindler's List. Flipping on to 76, new section, Mrs. White's Negro Sighting. One of the most damning revelations in the case surfaced almost by mistake, but it has become pivotal to understanding why so many were convinced that Leo Frank was indeed the murderer of Mary Fagan. And it involved his apparent hiding from authorities, the man who all of Frank's supporters claim was the actual murderer, James Connelly. Leo Frank steadfastly claimed that he had no knowledge that James Connelly was anywhere on the premises on the day of the murder, and Connelly maintained that he was at the factory only because Frank had asked him to stand sentry as Frank, quote, chatted, unquote, privately with his female visitors. inset photo, Mrs. Arthur White. Mary Fagan arrived at the factory just after noon and was believed to have been murdered a short time after that. During the crucial noon to 1 o'clock time frame, at least four people were at several different locations in the large and nearly vacant four-story factory. Among them were two workmen renovating part of the fourth floor, and Leo Frank working in his office on the second floor. One of the workers, named Arthur White, was visited at 12:30 by his wife Maggie, who brought him lunch just moments after the probable time of the murder. When she walked down the stairs to leave the building at about 12:50 p.m., Mrs. White reported that she saw an unfamiliar black man sitting near the elevator on the first floor, an observation she reported to the plant's personnel manager, N.V. Darley, once the tragedy became known. Darley then told Leo Frank, but according to Frank himself, he sent a messenger bearing this intelligence to his own hired investigator, Pinkerton agent Harry Scott, but not to the police. Now, here's a quote on this from a relevant footnote. She saw a Negro loitering around the factory at 1 o'clock, which it is thought he would have been very unlikely to do had he had anything to do with the disappearance of Mary Fagan, who was in the factory a few minutes after 12 o'clock. Frank's own unsworn courtroom explanation is in brief 213.14. Oddly, the Atlanta Journal records Frank as having been told that Mrs. White saw, quote, some Negroes, unquote, which may have been Frank trying to diminish the importance of the sighting. In fact, the story was not pursued for a full 12 days until an Atlanta City detective thought to re-interview Mrs. White on that 13th day. Frank himself, who was arrested on April 29th, sat in jail accused of murder for almost 2 weeks without mentioning this crucial sighting by Mrs. White. Prosecutor Hugh Dorsey believed that after first being forthcoming about what she had witnessed, Mrs. White became less so and implied that pressure from Frank's team was the reason. Quote, we've shown that Frank knew of this disclosure on April 28, and now we expect to show that although Detective Bass Rosser questioned this woman here on that same day, that she refused to disclose this information to him or to any detective working for the state, and that the state never knew of it until May 27th. The unidentified Negro, quote-unquote, that Mrs. White saw that day was obviously James Conley, who had positioned himself near the stairwell where he claimed Frank told him to sit as his, quote-unquote, lookout. Mrs. White's exit at 12:50 would have been about 40 minutes after Mary Fagan's murder and 6 minutes before Frank called Conley up to the second floor to help him conceal the body. It does not take much of a sleuth to appreciate the salvational power of this casual Conley sighting, yet Frank and his team appeared suspiciously unable to grasp its value to their cause. Frank had retained the services of a highly experienced team of lawyers and detectives. Luther Z. Rosser had achieved a legendary status as a defense lawyer in the state of Georgia, as did attorney Reuben Arnold, and the Pinkerton Detective Agency was the nation's most feared and respected outfit of its kind. Herbert and Leonard Haas were the National Pencil Company's attorneys, both well-known and highly respected in their field. An innocent Leo Frank and his formidable squad of professional defenders would have instantaneously seen Mrs. White's Negro sighting as no less than heaven sent, and would have made it central to Frank's defense. But they said and did nothing to pursue that lead or to force the police or the press to pursue it. It was only when Atlanta Detective Bass Rosser pressed the issue that the Frank team was no longer able to ignore that evidence. Next section, why Frank concealed Mrs. White's Negro. How could a strange, unknown, unexplained, unchaperoned, uninvited black man be seen lingering anywhere near the scene of a murdered white girl, and the news of this not lead to a sweeping, full-throttled manhunt by police, Frank, and his hired detectives? Indeed, Frank had already publicly declared the murder to be, quote, a Negro crime, a position he and his defenders held right on up until his own lynching in August of 1915. The only logical explanation is, as Connolly claimed, Frank was sticking to the arrangement he had made with Connolly to keep silent about the day's tragic events. According to Connolly, Frank had instructed him to keep their association a secret, counting on each other's silence to weather the storm, and both held to that pact, but when investigators learned of Mrs. White's Negro and sought to identify him, they began asking hard questions of the, quote, Negro sweeper they already had in custody. It has been claimed by some writers that Connolly had eluded serious suspicion because he was assumed to be illiterate and thus unable to write the notes left near the body. This alleged illiteracy, we are to believe, overruled the cause of his arrest, that he was caught washing blood from his shirt at the scene of an unsolved murder. In any event, it turns out that Leo Frank was in possession of a loan receipt signed by Connolly, indicating that he, Frank, had been paying the jewelry store $1 a week from Connolly's salary for a purchase he had made. In fact, Connolly had signed the contract in front of Leo Frank. Frank thus knew of Connolly's ability to write, but never volunteered that information. When Frank was confronted with this, he claimed that it was he, Frank, who revealed to police that Connolly could write and thus made Connolly a serious suspect. Both the police and the Pinkerton detectives denied Frank had made any such statement to them at all. Steve Oney's research confirms the Pinkerton police version, finding no record of Frank's claim. So he's lying about that. The reality is that Frank knew the significance of Mrs. White's observation. Investigators had deduced that the, quote, Negro they had in custody could write and had been present at the crime scene when the crime had been committed, a fact that could no longer be contained. As scholar Albert Lindemann admitted, Frank, quote, did not even mention Connolly to the police until it was unavoidable, as if he feared to have Connolly interrogated. Had Mrs. White's observation been suppressed, as the Frank team tried to have done, Connolly would never have been connected to the scene, and Newt Lee, believed to be the only black man anywhere near the scene of this horrific, quote, Negro crime, would probably have paid with his life. Frank said nothing to relieve Lee, even though he had knowledge of another likely suspect. Frank instead urged police, through concocted and planted evidence, to shift suspicion to the night watchman. When the episode was aired at Frank's trial, his lawyers actually tried to have White's evidence thrown out, calling it irrelevant, immaterial, and not binding. They were unsuccessful. It was so significant that when revealed during the trial, the Atlanta Constitution reported the reaction of the audience. Colon, block quote, "It was at this moment that something occurred that had never occurred before during the progress of the trial. A burst of applause swept through the courtroom, and several people clapped their hands loudly as though applauding at the theater, something that met their approval. The deputies immediately began rapping for order, and Judge Roan announced from the bench that such action would not be tolerated." To the lay audience, and certainly to the jury of his peers, Frank's apparent indifference to the news of a black suspect, or worse, his concealment of that man, was yet more proof of the defendant's guilt. Add to this the damaging testimony of a solid Frank supporter, his second-in-command at the factory, Herbert Schiff. At trial and under oath, he admitted, quote, "I knew on Monday, April 28th, that Mrs. White claimed she saw a Negro there." 3-year employee Mrs. E.M. Carson testified that a group of factory employees were discussing the murder when they returned to work on the Monday morning immediately after Saturday's crime. Not only were they already aware of and commenting on Mrs. White's sighting, but they had further speculated that the black man she saw must have been the killer. Footnote 167. Mrs. Carson's daughter, Rebecca Carson, would surface in the case as the woman seen going into the fourth-floor woman's dressing room with Leo M. Frank. She would later provide key but questionable eyewitness testimony about Frank's whereabouts on the afternoon of the murder. Mrs. Carson further testified that she said these words directly to James Connolly, who had returned to the factory for work as usual on Monday. Block quote, "Jim, whenever they find the murderer of Mary Fagan, it's going to be that nigger that was sitting near the elevator when Mrs. White went upstairs." footnote 168. Another sleight-of-hand nuance here becomes apparent. Mrs. White clearly and emphatically says twice that she saw, quote, a Negro as she was going downstairs at 12:50 p.m., but Frank's lawyers and witnesses and Frank himself continued to deliberately misstate when Miss White saw the Negro, claiming falsely that she saw him on her way upstairs, 12:30 p.m. They were trying, by this maneuver, to place Connolly at the scene closer to Mary Fagan's moment of death. More lies from the Jews. This shows that even though Frank said he was totally unaware of it, a black man's presence at the murder scene was common knowledge immediately after the crime was committed, even among the rank-and-file factory employees, and in their minds that fact was central to Frank's exoneration. If these amateur observers could so quickly deduce those facts, one must just as quickly deduce that the silence of Leo Frank and his team of lawyers and private investigators corroborates Connolly's version of events. When the fact of Connolly's presence confronted Frank, he realized that his only option was to cut Connolly loose, as it were, and he moved for the second time to pin his crime on a black man. Frank and his partisans have tried to address that incredibly damning behavior by posing Frank as the hero of the episode, he having revealed to the police Connolly's ability to write. As previously shown, there is no record of that claim. But according to the Georgian, early on in the investigation, Frank took charge. Quote, "The canvas of employees was made under the direction of Frank himself," unquote. Just before his arrest, Frank told the paper that, quote, "every one of the foremen and the headmen about the factory is endeavoring to find out if any of the employees know anything." If Frank had truly intended to find the murderer, he, having knowledge of Mrs. White's, quote, "lurking Negro," unquote, could have simply assembled all his black employees to determine their exact whereabouts on that day and to administer a writing test, and Connolly would have been at the top of that writer's list, by Frank's own personal knowledge. Nor did any of the other white employees speak up, several of whom claimed that they had always known of Connolly's ability to write. Herbert Schiff, who was involved in the investigation from the beginning, was very clear in his testimony, block quote, "I knew Jim could write. I've given him and the other Negroes tablets like this," states Exhibit H. "They are kept everywhere in the factory. They would go down in the basement and write." The handling of Mrs. White's revelation by Frank and his team of practiced legal veterans is possibly the most compelling evidence of Frank's guilt. That they would allow the arrest, confinement, and persecution, quote-unquote, of their prominent and wealthy white client before a full investigation of the, quote, "lurking black man," was simply gross, unforgivable legal malpractice, and on a broader but no less important level, racial malfeasance. The incident was also a problem for Charles and Louise Samuels, author of the book Night Fell on Georgia. They wrote that Frank, quote, "always insisted that he passed on this information to the police," but they added, "why this promising lead was never followed up remains one of the baffling features of the case." Footnote 173, Samuels, Nightfall 64. It is interesting that Oney presents this information as evidence of Connolly's guilt. ATDSR. Leonard Dinnerstein and Jeffrey Melnick don't even mention Mrs. White in their books, so you see how thoroughly, utterly dishonest Jews are at every step and at every level. And that mostly concludes what we're going to do today. There's one more graphic. Timeline of the murder of Mary Fagan on page 83. Good graphic. Shows all the players involved, their facial little facial shots. Alonzo Mann, we haven't got to yet. Helen Ferguson, Herbert Haas, Herbert Schiff, James Gant, James Jim Connolly, Lemmy Quinn, Montine Stover, Mrs. Arthur White, Manola McKnight, N.V. Darley, and Newt Lee. I'll just read through the timeline and that will conclude this section. So, there's the most likely timeline, there's Alonzo Mann's disputed timeline, and Leo Frank's disputed timeline. So, most likely, arrive at factory. Holloway 6:30, Denham 7:30, Mann 8, Campbell 9:30 to 9:40. Well, I don't think it'll work very well if I verbally describe it, but it's in the book, so it just shows everything that happens on that day. Yeah, anyway, that will do with this third session of the Leo Frank, Volume 3, the Leo Frank case, the secret relationship between blacks and Jews, Number 3, the Leo Frank case, the lynching of a guilty man, booked by the Nation of Islam. And we're up through page 84. And thanks for being with me today, and we'll pick up again and continue next time, which will happen real soon.